Good morning. I like to sing. I want to sing a little with you. Maybe I'll do this song, even though many of you probably know it, just as a little bit of a learning call and response. The mind can go in 1,000 directions. So,
the mind can go
in 1,000 directions, in 1,000 directions, but on this lovely path, I walk in peace. Don't do the whole thing. The mind can go in 1,000 directions, but on this lovely path, I walk in peace. You could just say path, doesn't have to be lovely. The mind can go in 1,000 directions, but on this lovely path I walk in peace. The next part goes, with each step, a gentle wind blows. With each step, a flower blooms. With each step, a gentle wind blows. With each step, a flower blooms. Whole song. The mind can go in 1,000 directions, but on this lovely path I walk in peace. With each step a gentle wind blows, with each step a flower blooms. This is a song about empowerment. It is. My mind can go in 1,000 directions, but on this path I walk in peace. That's your power. Right? It's about a strong determination not to go into all the habit energy, the spinning, the turning, the running, the craving, the fear, to stay on the path. I walk in peace. There's another song. The realm of the mind is mine. The realm of the mind is mine. I can choose where I want to be. I can choose where I want to be. The realm of the mind is mine. I can choose where I want to be. Both heaven and hell, I know equally well. The choice is, excuse me, the choice is up to me. The choice is up to me. The realm of the mind is mine. I can choose where I want to be. Both heaven and hell I know equally well. The choice is up to me. Ditto. Right? We do the practice. We trust and trust ourselves to the practice, and it builds an experience in us that we can have confidence in. And we know, I can choose this. This is my way. Now, sometimes it's really, really hard not to go in 1,000 directions or to be pulled in a downward spiral into a kind of vortex of suffering. Sometimes when we hear like the sutra that we read this morning and the breathings, you hear breathing in, I feel joyful. Breathing out, I really don't feel joyful. Yeah. Breathing in, oh, the next one, I feel happy. Baloney. I don't feel happy, I'm unhappy, right? And we're stuck, we're caught. We're caught in our pessimism, and we're caught in our suffering, we're caught in our fear, we're caught in our anguish. And many of us, all of us have encountered, and many of us are encountering situations in our lives where we are in some anguish, where we're in some pain. And it's really hard to pick ourselves up out of that. So yesterday when I was sharing about nourishment and protection, how important it is for us to take time, to make time, and schedule our lives so that we do have some nourishment, so that the wholesome seeds in our consciousness can be watered, can grow stronger. It's just clear, if you don't take the time to do it, they won't be growing except by chance. And sure, you can live your life that way if you'd like. I don't like. I suffer when I do that. And so I want to, I'm striving always. And I don't think there's ever a point where I get it all figured out, but I'm striving always, like I'd have the perfect system, right? That's not the point. It's that striving always to find the ways to allow nourishment to happen. Like a retreat like this is a kind of nourishment, deep nourishment on so many levels, levels we're not even aware of, right? You make the time for that. But we can make little moments too, and how important it is, right? Just not to leave it to chance, but to take up the path. Actually, a path isn't a path unless you're someone's walking on it, right? Right, so we got to do that. We have to embody this practice. And then there's the protecting element, and I introduced that idea of putting a sentinel of mindfulness at each of the sense doors. The eyes, become aware of what's coming in through your eyes. Do it right now. Just bring your awareness to your eyes. What are they taking in? What are the shapes and colors, right? Your ears and the sounds that come, the vibrations, right? Take a breath through your nose. There is scent there. There's fragrance there. Go to your tongue with your awareness. It will start watering and you'll know the taste in your mouth. I hope it's okay. Yeah. The sense doors, they're there. We're constantly receiving this input from life as it's unfolding, right? Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. Bring your awareness to your hands right now. Just without moving them, without doing anything, just where are they? Can you feel through the surface of the skin in your hands and fingers? The touch, the warmth, the texture if you did move it, right? How about the soles of your feet? Actually, this particular sense door is more than just hands and feet, but I like to use my hands and feet to get me in there, right? But really the entire surface of our body, and then all the feelings, sensations that are a part of our, you know, all through the insides of our body too, right? That sense door is quite a bit of information. It's a lot of input there. I do a meditation where I go through all of the six senses. You know, the mind is considered a sense because it operates the same way as the other senses do. My eyes are, sorry, maybe a little bit of water would be good. This seems to be recurring. My eyes open, right, are the sensory organ, right, and the shape of the eye and everything going on with the lens and the retina and the optic nerve going back into the head, right? My eye is the sensory organ. And then there's the forms and colors, the light and the shadow out here. And because the two things come together, the subject and the object, the seeing happens. The eye, the forms and the colors, and the seeing. They're all together, right? But that's how the basic structure of the sense perception. We can go into detail into how confusing that actually is if you think about it. The way the lens works and flips everything upside down and backwards, and then how your optic nerve spins it around a few times before it gets into your brain where you recreate the image of what's actually outside and think you're looking at it. Sorry, I just wanted to confuse you a little. Can you follow that? Can you imagine being the light going in? I like this impression. I am seeing happening, going in someone's eye, and now I'm upside down, and now I'm spinning around, and now I'm a projection in the brain, right? That's the eyes perceiving, but subject, object, and the event, the perception, the seeing. The ears the same way, with vibration and sound and hearing, the nose, the tongue, the body. Yeah. Thank you, Ross. And the mind works the same way. There's the thinker, the thing thought about, and the thought. Right? There's the subject, the object of mind, the subject, mind, the object of mind. And there's the thinking. So we call that another sense organ, sensory perception, just like the other ones. This one is particularly important because if you remember the diagram that I drew yesterday, and I'm going to draw it again in a slightly different way in a few minutes, but if you remember, the mind is sitting right there in the middle, and the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body are bringing in this experience of life unfolding in the present moment. And it comes in unfiltered, clear, just as it is, until it gets to the mind, where we interpret it, where we play with it, where we change it, where we evaluate it, where we categorize it, right? And in that activity then is stored within us. The results of that activity is stored in the ground, the soil, we call alaya consciousness, A-L-A-Y-A. Alaya consciousness, the store consciousness, where all the potentials, all the memories, all the conditioning, all the habit energies, all the learned experiences that we've ever had are stored. Right? So the mind rests between this incredible store of experiences, many of them happy, many of them sad, many of them, right, full of vitality, and other ones not so, right? And all of that's there, also pressing into our mind consciousness, as well as the present moment experience. So it's really important for the sentinel of mindfulness to be developed. And so much of meditation practice is exactly this, right? Being present in our inner life to the extent that we can discern when something is arising out of habit and conditioning from stored consciousness, or whether it's coming from the direct experience of reality. And if we can discern that, we can do a lot of wonderful things. This is the empowerment that these songs are talking about. It's in the realm of the mind. Just for the, you know, sake of this, in these discussions, the word mind is synonymous with heart also, because I'm not talking about an intellectual, rational experience of mind. We're talking about a lived, embodied, felt experience of our inner life, right? Thoughts and feelings are inseparable. They are each other. There was a time in my life as a monk, early on, when I still love to garden, to do things in the soil. But that time I really wanted to be active doing gardening. And I really wanted to be a part of sort of the garden crew in Upper Hamlet where I lived in Plum Village. And, you know, grow things in the greenhouse and tend the landscaping. But I was always asked to do other things. But when I had the opportunity to, I would jump in. And there was one older brother, a brother whose Dharma name was Vongai, which means no obstacles. Really, really lovely brother. He would invite me, because he knew I liked to be in the garden, he would invite me to help him. Like, so he'd pull me out of other things. He was an older brother, so he could do that. He pulled me out of organizational activities and things like that and get me out into the garden. And one day he asked me to come help him transplant something. He said, "I want you to help me do this. I know how to transplant it," but he really loved the garden. He wanted me to transplant this flowering bush. And he said, "I want you to do it because you have that green thumb thing. Everything you touch grows." And he really wanted my involvement. So I helped him out. And while we were placing this plant in the ground, he looked at me and he goes, "Phap Hien," that's my name in Vietnamese, it's Phap Hien. "Phap Hien, you don't smile very much. You're not very joyful." I was a little bit shocked because that's not how I saw myself. I thought that I was a pretty joyful person, and I'd always been involved in music and theater and performance and things and doing all this stuff. So I was a little bit shocked with the reflection. And I didn't say anything back. I just kind of took it in like, oh, really, that's how he's experiencing me. And I went to the meditation hall later that day for our afternoon sitting, and I held that feeling. I was a little bit uncomfortable with feeling judged. Let's see what was under there. And it was really quick for me to realize that he was right. Like, I said, I was kind of like, I'm joyful, aren't I? I can sit here and be happy. And I was like, where's that feeling of joy? I couldn't find it. I hadn't even seen that it disappeared on me somewhere along the way. So I sat with that experience for a little bit and realized that I'm really good. I should say I was. I was really good at riding on other people's joy. So when someone else brought some joy, I could experience that with them. I could be happy with them. When I was performing music, I could pull with my music people's joy out and ride with it. You know. But when I was sitting by myself, I couldn't find it. It was depressing. But I was very enthusiastic practitioner. I said, I'm going to grow the seed of joy in me. And so I did. I'm telling you this story because it's really, it just, I feel like it's actually a pretty simple process. The seeds in our consciousness, they have their particular nature, their quality. It's what they do. So, for example, in this case, the seed of joy in me, right, produces an experience of joy when it's active in me, when it's alive in me. But if it's not strong, if I don't know where it is, I don't know how to access that experience in me, it can't. So I have to grow it. I've got to give it food and nourishment. Well, I did simple exercises. I did a lot of it on the cushion, but I also did it through the day. On the cushion, I sat. And there's the meditation, Flower Fresh. And this is actually what showed me that I couldn't find my joys, because I said, I can be fresh and joyful like a flower. Breathing in, I see myself as a flower. Breathing out, what kind of flower am I? I don't know. Am I flowering at all? You know, like I had so much doubt and it was just stuck. So I said, okay, I'm going to choose a tiny little kind of flower. I chose a lobelia, which is a little tiny, like grow with little teeny, tons of teensy tiny ones on like rock walls and things. And I chose that little flower, or a little tiny violet under the grass, something like that. So, okay, that's me hiding under the grass. That's my joy. All right. Let me see myself as that. And I would just imagine myself as that and have no feeling whatsoever of joy. But I stuck with it. And I kept doing it, and eventually I was finding myself quite entertaining. And it was, I began to experience a little bit of warmth around that, a little bit of color. And I mean, eventually, like, I did this every day for a number of days, for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes during sitting meditation, just trying to breathe and think of things that should bring me joy. And over time, they started to bring me joy. I had to train my mind to be able to access this energy. I know this energy when it comes from you, right? I know how to feel it, but I just didn't know how to go inside and find it. So I used those images from the world around me to show myself what it's like inside to have that, and eventually found reflections of it as I walked through the day and would stop and really say, okay, I want to let that grow in me a little bit and take it in. And over time, I found the seed of joy in me, not like a little lobelia flower, but like a dandelion or even a dahlia or something like that. I was able to really exercise this muscle to the point where it grew quite strong. And that taught me a lot about the power of my mind, that simple statement from my brother, that reflection. You don't smile very much. You're not joyful. And, you know, he said it seriously and playfully at the same time. But I took that and I learned a lot. There was another time after I left the monastery when my kids were little, and I found that I had a lot of anger in me and I didn't know why. But I could be standing at the kitchen sink doing the dishes. My child would come up and tug on my pants and say, "Dad, can you help me get something down from the shelf?" Because they couldn't reach it, and I'd want to snap at them. I'd catch my energy, like wanting to be angry that my child was asking for 30 seconds of my help. I was like, what's going on? I felt so reactive, so much energy just under the surface. And I know the practice, so I'm going, okay, this is something I need to hold this. And it kept coming day after day. I was feeling this more and more. I was like, oh, this is hard. And I really started to feel like I was suppressing it. I'm holding it back. I'm holding something back that really is trying to express itself, this frustration, this stress, this tension. And a couple of moments, it really started to erupt for me. I became very angry. And I could see the pain it would cause. And I was kind of stuck, because I was like, this seed in me is really strong. And I want to be able to embrace it. But to embrace it, I have to have it. And to have it means I'm going to be yelling at someone. Right? So I felt kind of stuck. That's the situation with anger. It's tricky. Because you want to be like, oh, I have to embrace my anger. Oh, that's a risky business, because, you know, you could lash out at anyone because that anger is really alive in you, and even at yourself, right? And I went to a day of mindfulness with some of the brothers that I knew from before, and I asked them this question. I said, yeah, I'm kind of at this moment, I'm a little bit stuck on something. And one of the brothers said to me, just remember, if there's a seed that's really strong in you right now, somehow you've been feeding it. Somehow you've been nourishing it. It can't be there without nourishment. Right away, when I heard those words, I went, right, I gotta reframe this. It's not about letting the anger up so I can hold it. It's about understanding how it got here and taking care of the causes, the roots underneath. Anger is the result of a whole bunch of other sufferings, and they have causes. All these little conditions coming together become, in their culmination, the rage, the frustration, the hatred. But underneath that, there are many small things contributing. And that's really cool. The nourishment that created the anger was coming from very small experiences of stress and tension in my daily life. A little overwhelm here, a little bit too much stress there, trying to take on a relationship that was hard over there. And all these little things. And I could impact the whole experience of my anger by holding and understanding and transforming these smaller moments in my daily life. It changed the experience right away. The intensity started to go down very fast as I began to de-stress. Stress is cumulative. Stress, tension, suffering, right? It's cumulative. And little by little by little by little by little, it builds up. So we don't have to take the whole big thing and figure it out. We can take out the little stresses here and there and here and there. And it takes the strength and intensity out of the whole experience of the anger. It's pretty easy, guys. It's pretty easy to stop for an hour and take a snapshot of your life in this moment and see where the stressful things are and see where you're picking it up. You can take out a pad of paper and sort of just start noting the things that bring about stress and tension for you, and then the conditions that bring you joy and happiness, and see them right there in front of you, and be like, okay, these are the things I'm doing that water the seeds of suffering in me, and these are the things I'm doing that water the seeds of happiness in me. It's pretty easy to see. We can all do it. Once you see it, there's a path. And Thich Nhat Hanh would summarize this as the Four Noble Truths, he would say. When you have suffering and you understand how it came to be, you know what to do and what not to do in order to transform the situation. Yeah, the path becomes clear. Now we understand, now we can walk it. Now we're empowered. We bring our mindfulness into our sensory experiences, into our mind itself. We hold ourselves in awareness, see what's coming in and out, understand what effect it has on us, and the path becomes clear. I can choose. I can choose where I want to be. My daughter loves to shop, especially for clothes. I'm actually starting to like it. I'm starting to experience her joy, or through her, learn how to be joyful in shopping for clothes. Clothes were always very simple for me. I never even considered that there was such a thing as matching an outfit for your mood. But it's kind of fun. So I'm getting into her world a little bit, but it also got me thinking about clothes. Because when I look at my daughter, I don't see her clothes. I see a wonderful expression of life that has deep meaning to me, right? And it really doesn't matter to me which outfit she's wearing. And I'm the worst critic or mirror for her. Like, how does this look, Dad? It always looks great, you know. I'm actually learning. This is what I'm learning. I'm learning to get into the nuanced details of it and play with it a little bit. But 'cause when I look at her, I see beneath the surface all the time. And it's all I want to see in her, right? However she dresses, however she ends up. When she had her the brain injury a year and a half ago, she had a brain injury. It was really hard. She lost her speech, her movement, and was in incredible pain for months, and was extremely confused and scared because of the experience. That in itself was a trauma, right? And I had to go through, Fern and I both, our whole family had to go through an experience of like this person that we, this being who was a treasure for us, who was who is going through something and might not come out, almost certainly would not come out the same, right? And she didn't come out the same, but she's doing really well now, just to tell you that part of the story. But she, going through that was a whole process of like even shedding any idea I had about who she might be or where she might go or the kind of things she might do, because we didn't know if she would recover or if she would always be on our couch for us to take care of, you know? So I had to let go even of the layers of my ideas about her that they weren't on the surface, but there was still attachment there, perhaps, to like, what is a life supposed to be? What's it supposed to look like? And what's the value in that? And any feelings of attachment or longing or wish for her or for anyone that we might have, right, that are under the surface there. Even those layers I had to let go of. And really get into the experience of what it was to love and care for a human being, no matter who they were or how they manifested. I think I've always been striving to do that with everyone, but it takes moments like that to actually get into the work and go through it inside. So I'm speaking about this because of clothes. and I was thinking about it like, it's so clear for me when I look at her that the clothes are this appearance, this outer, an outfit. It's like this presentation on the outside, this sign, this mark of something. And yet there's something so much more wonderful under the surface that's ungraspable by my ideas. It's untouchable by, you know, the outfit can't actually express it, whatever outfit she wears, right? It won't be able to express the real meaning that's in her to me. Our mind is like that. This place in us, it's constantly changing outfits. It's putting on an appearance like this, it's putting on a habit energy like that, right? It's suffering with an ancestral transmission like this, and it's, right? It's going through all these different changing of outfits, figuring itself out. But underneath, it's actually something very meaningful and powerful in its clarity, in its essence. And when we're able to clear that space and really drop in and get to know the raw, simple, pure function of the mind, it's awesome. The task of the meditator is to know all these layers of the mind, to be able to have some fun maybe with changing outfits. With finding the appropriate clothing for the situation. We do need that kind of skillfulness. And I tell you, she's skillful with it in terms of clothes. And we in our minds need to be skillful in finding the right orientation for a particular moment, the right practice for a particular mental formation or suffering or joy or relationship. We do need to have that skill. We also need to know what's underneath, and open that door to that raw, simple power of what it is, to have that choice, to be able to contribute and participate in the reshaping the remaking, the remanifesting of the world in every moment. This world we're living in, it's not outside of us. It's manifesting from inside of us. So there's a whole bunch of techniques that we use for this, like breathing in and out. We're helping our mind to rest a little and not to just run and be lost trying to find the right outfit, right? But we're gonna rest a little, see, oh, which outfit will be the right one to wear. When Tai would teach breathing meditation, he would say, follow your in-breath from the beginning to the end. Breathing in, I know that I'm breathing in all the way to the end. He would do that with his fingers and go up. He'd get the end and go, whew. And breathing out, I'm aware that I'm breathing out. In, all the way out. All the way. Well, in reality, your breath might be like this. In, out. In, out. But the idea is, stay with it all the way on the in-breath, all the way on the out-breath. My mind, yeah, it needs something else to do. That's too simple. Well, now I can do that now. But when I started this practice, I couldn't do that. I couldn't just stay with it because I was fast enough in my mind to know that I'm still with my in-breath while I'm thinking about this phone call I have to make. And you know, in-breath, yep. And I got to do that, yep, still in-breath. Okay, out-breath. And we're going to do this too. Okay, now we're on the next in-breath. And it's good practice anyway. You try it anyway. So some people say, count your breath. Gives your mind something to do, right? Okay, breathing in, one. What was that person's name? Still in one. And two. Yeah, so you breathe in, one. Breathe out, one. Breathe in, two. Breathe out, two. These are ways for you to kind of stay more closer to your breath. But if you're like me, your mind is still going to run in between a little bit. But you will develop some concentration that way, and settle, and spaciousness will come a little bit to the mind, for sure. Eventually, though, the counting has to go. One thing that worked for me, because I was a piano player, and I loved to do things with my hand, was instead of using my mind to count, because I just felt like that kept me up here, I was going to use my fingers. So I put them on my belly, and I would feel the in-breath happen, out-breath happen, and switch finger, in-breath happen, out-breath happen, and switch my finger for each breath in and out. And in that way, I didn't have to be like, this is one, two, right? I could relax a little bit more into the sensation of breathing. And that helped tremendously to get me out of my busyness and out of my running. Let's get down into the feeling of breathing in the body. Just breathing, nothing more. I'm not trying to get in touch with everything that's in my body, just the sensation of breathing. Right? And I'd go to five, I'd go my thumb to my pinky and then back down to my thumb and then gently switch hands. And it kept me active and engaged in the process without having to run around in my mind. And if I was engaged, if my mind was going to be doing something, it's like time to switch hands, right? So I'm still right here. Feeling and embodying the breath. This is also a really helpful practice if you're doing deep relaxation and you want to stay awake. Yeah, you put a hand on your belly while you breathe in and out. And gently switch hands. Put your other hand on your belly for your next breath. It's a little bit of activity that'll keep you awake. Every breath, switching your hands gently, one left to right, left to right. But it still allows you to relax a lot. Yeah. So this was like getting out of my head into the breath itself. Relaxing the senses is another way that we can give space to our mind. Like I did at the beginning of this talk, be aware of your eyes. Relax them. Let them just be there. See. Be aware of the ears. Relax them. Your ears can relax. So it's a strange one at first for most of us. The ears actually do have tension in them, and you can relax them. And one of my favorites is the tongue. So every time I bring my awareness to my tongue, my whole jaw wants to relax. Oh, shit. I don't realize how much tension I pull there. Right? Yeah. Relaxing the senses also helps. It's a wonderful way to bring this spaciousness, this ease, and the concentration begins to form. We go little by little, deeper by deeper, into that space of knowing ourselves from the inside out. It's the same image that I made yesterday, just with some more words. I like it because it gives me a real visual representation of this very special place that the mind, our inner life, has, receiving reality in the moment, unfolding, but also pressed upon by all the memory, the condition, and the transmission of our ancestors. Yeah. And so yesterday I talked about how a seed in our consciousness, a possibility of something in our consciousness like anger or like joy, right, might be a possibility down here. And through events in daily life, like the words of my older brother came in through my eyes and ears, right, I received this message, you're not very joyful, and made me a little bit upset, like touched the seed of being judged and being. But then I woke up in my life, I acted in such a way that I could draw up the possibility of being joyful and learned how to do that and create this potential down here in the store of memory, habit, energy, and conditioning. I conditioned myself into joy, right? Our whole life is conditioning. We're constantly being conditioned by our environment. But the idea here is that we can participate in it, right? So when I have a reaction to my child saying, I hate you, that ancestral transmission of children cannot talk to their parents like that comes up into my mind and takes over the space, and I want to yell at my child. I want to tell them what's right and what's wrong, right? Comes, wants to go out into the world, but I have the opportunity to hold it, right? And impact it, share with that deep memory of my ancestors something that might help to bring spaciousness and ease. And my breathing, my patience, my understanding that I know this isn't about my child, right? That this is coming from elsewhere. I hold that, and then it settles back down, reconditioned. So we're actually reconditioning Alaya consciousness. So sometimes the seed of suffering in us is strong because we're doing things in our daily life that's watering it and making it strong. Like maybe you have a lot of fear and anxiety about what's happening in the world. The only way you have that fear and anxiety is because you're reading or watching and being in touch with stories of suffering in the world. So you're doing something which is helping to create your fear and anxiety of what's happening in the world, right? So some of that comes from there. But there's also fear and anxiety down here that's very old. The fear and anxiety of our ancestors who have lived through lack of resources, war, and oppression. It's already there in us, deep like that, right? So it also comes from there. It's really important to understand that, because the burden that we feel of our suffering doesn't actually belong to us, most of it. We don't need to take it on like that, make it so important about us, define who we are. Who we are is in this moment how we receive it and what we do with it, right? So when I know that it comes from my ancestors, when I know that the suffering that I'm feeling is my ancestral transmission, I'm not expecting that I can solve the problem. It took lifetimes for this suffering to become what it is right now. It will take lifetimes for it to be healed. So we have to have that kind of intelligence. Otherwise, we're going to try to do something we can't do, and we're going to frustrate ourselves and feel disappointed and despair. Right? This is like a huge, beautiful tapestry of life. Right? And it's being woven, so many threads, so many beings are weaving their stories together into this tapestry of life. And we've been given a particular few threads to carry. Out of the whole tapestry of countless threads, we have a few. And we have an opportunity in our daily life to weave them beautifully or not. Right? But that's what we're given, just these few. We're not trying to author the whole tapestry. We have to see our place in that flow of life. Because I think a lot of us suffer because we're trying to hold the suffering of the collective as an individual. But there are problems in our life and in the life of our society and in the world that belong to all of us, and we are all going to have to do our part to transform those sufferings. It's not something that I will be able to do just myself. One step at a time. I have this thread. I will do my best to weave it beautifully as I can. And maybe I will see a result, and maybe not. Some of us in this room have lived through generations and seen changes. Things that when you were 40 years ago, 50 years ago, you would never have imagined could be happening, right? You'd have thought that would have been nice. But there it is, right? I love your sweatshirt. What if it all works out? Right? The part that we're asked to carry can work out. It's not about a result. That's about the doing, right? We're not fixing a problem. We're contributing our best to the embracing and understanding of it. And so sometimes in our daily life, we really do see the effects of our practice manifesting as transformation, as healing, as new relationships and things like that. But then there are other tracks. They're old and deep, and they're going to take a long time to work out. So let's not beat up ourselves or give each other a hard time. It takes a while to be able to understand the who's and the why's and the how's of our ancestral suffering. Yeah. And we're going to feel very fragile when we start to open up the new ways of looking at collective suffering. What's happening right now in our social justice movements around the world. And it takes a lot of work here in the heart just to hold space and sort of for even the possibility that the way that I live my life might have something to do with all that suffering. Right? Those are big stories, really big stories. So a lot of patience, a lot of loving kindness for ourselves, for our neighbors, as we slowly learn to grapple with the big stories together. What's amazing to me nowadays is that we actually are starting to do this together, right? Collective awakening is happening in the sense of the practice, Four Noble Truths, spring us back. There's suffering and there's causes of suffering. We're starting to understand together as masses of millions of people around the world, some of these collective sufferings, where they come from, how they came about, right? We're starting to do that work, which is never done before. There's still a lot of, no, this is me and that's you, and sort of this keeping of separation that's still present in the world. Again, it's really old and really big and really powerful. But for our part, today, I used to work in social rehab before I went to Plum Village. There was this really illuminating moment. I was not very experienced in that work, and my administrator was. And I was having trouble talking to a particular client in the social rehab home who was really upset about things that were going wrong for her. And I was having trouble, like, even consoling her. My administrator came over and sort of took over for me. But she did it in a really simple, down-to-earth way. She said, "So, I understand that you're feeling really bad right now, but can we just stop for a sec? I'm wondering, because we've been here all day." It was like 4:30 in the afternoon. "We've been here all day, and today, how much time during the course of the day were things actually really going wrong?" And to her credit, the client stopped and thought through her day. She was like, "Well, I got in that fight with so-and-so at breakfast, and then I got that letter with the bad news at about 11. And she's like, "Well, really about 25 minutes? Right? Like, you got up at 6 and it's 4:30 and 25 minutes of your day were bad." And she was like, "Oh, that's not too bad." And she walked away. So the administrator, I was like, "That's awesome." She flipped, turned it inside out. You know, I was caught in the emotion of it. But she took that step back because she had experience. She had been doing this work for a long time and was able to hold a perspective which helped the client see themselves, like, "Oh, man, it's not that bad. My day is actually going okay." For the most part, most of our days are going okay, most days, right? Where it's not going okay, I mean, in terms of reality, where it's not going okay is in here. Right? But that's also the place that we have the most power and agency. This is where we develop our practice, in our hearts, in our minds. I have two more things to share. One is this exercise. So stretch yourself out for a sec. Okay, this is a little guided meditation. In just a moment, we'll listen to the sound of the bell to start. And then I'm going to offer a guided meditation on what we call gladdening the mind. Gladdening the mind. But it's going to be based on this experience or this way of holding things that I've been talking about with the senses, the 18 realms of elements, the six senses. So it will begin with helping our mind to rest by relaxing through the senses, and then it will conclude with focusing our mind into a clear and beautiful thought. So we'll start with the bell. breathing in and out, I draw my awareness up to my eyes, and I fill my eyes, the organs of my eyes, with awareness, feeling with my awareness the space of my eyes. And as I sit and rest here, I open my eyes slightly so that I can see down and before me. And I am aware that my eyes are seeing forms and colors. And now I am aware how behind my eyes is my mind interpreting what I see. Blue, red, brown, light, dark. And I release my mind. No need to interpret. No need to understand. And I return my awareness to simply seeing. And I let my eyes close. And I bring my awareness to my ears, breathing in and out, aware of my ears, and relaxing my ears. And I am aware of my ears hearing sounds and vibrations. And how my ears are receiving sound, bringing it into me, and how my mind is talking about those sounds, is interpreting them. And I invite my mind to calm, to rest, and bring my awareness back out to my ears, simply hearing. And I bring my awareness to my nose and to my mouth and tongue. And as I breathe in and out, I sense smell and taste, my nose and my tongue smelling, tasting. And I am aware of my mind receiving that impression, interpreting it in one way or another. And I invite my mind to rest. And I return my awareness to the nose and the tongue, simply smelling, simply tasting. And now I allow my awareness to flow down through my neck and shoulders and out my arms to wrists and hands and fingers. And I am aware of the tactile sense, touch, of my body. I send my awareness down through my hips and legs to my feet and toes, sensing touch, contact. And I am aware of my mind interpreting and labeling the sensations of touch. I invite my mind to be calm and spacious. I soften my heart and return to sensing my hands and feet touch. Having relaxed all my eyes and ears, nose, tongue, and body, I draw myself in to my heart space, softening and opening. And here in the heart of me, with my mind clear, I form and intend a beautiful thought. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be free of affliction. May I be well. I hold and I intend and I feel the meaning of this thought. Breathing in and out. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be free of affliction. May I be well. Let us listen to the bell. Thank you for practicing that meditation together. gladdening the mind. You could say heart too if you like. So the last thing I want to share today in this talk is about bringing this perspective of ancestral transmission together with the teachings on interbeing. They're the same thing. We inter-are with our ancestors. We cannot take them out of us. They cannot take us out of them. This is what's beneath the surface, right? This is not the outfit. This is deep beneath the surface. I look like somebody called Michael, who's 51 years old, right? Living in New Hampshire, wearing some brown coat. But that's not what I really am. Yeah. But there's a transmission from countless beings pouring into this experience, this manifestation that's right here, and it's the same for each one of us. Right? We started the retreat with this awareness. Yeah. This is a solid ground that we can lean on, rest on. Sometimes the transmission doesn't feel very solid. But all in all, just like 25 minutes of our day were bad, right? There's so much there. It's very powerful. And beyond discriminating, suffering, happiness, and all that, this is the solid ground of reality, right? Ungraspable by concepts. We can point at it. We can draw pretty diagrams. We can use words like ancestral transmission. But it's really ungraspable how massive and how awesome this is. Just like if you were a wave on the surface of the ocean, you could maybe flathead would work, it's big enough. But if you were a wave on the surface of the ocean, could you comprehend the total volume of water? Right? The depths, the vastness of it. It's limitless. Right? And that's the real ground of who and what we are. So if we can find ways to hold our awareness of that as we move through our life, we have a stability and a freedom. It's the same stability and the freedom that the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara knows when she rides on the waves of birth and death. Right? She's a surfer. And yeah, that's it. The original surfer, Avalokita. And that means that the appearance and disappearance of a wave, whatever outfit is being worn, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, right? There's a deep solid ground beneath that you don't have to worry too much about these things. Right? Gives you that stability and that freedom to come from the best place of you and not be carried away. If you know where you come from like that, you know where you're going. And if you know where you come from and where you're going, you don't have to worry. You don't have to be anxious. Touching the earth last night was a practice all about that. Right? You're touching the earth, but you're touching the sort of the depths of your being, beyond conceptual grasp. So lovely, okay? But we use concepts to touch it. We use our daily life to touch it, like this. Do you remember on the opening night, it was talking about breathing in and out with the forest? There's breathing in and out because, like, you hear the sound of the bell and you need to stop moving. Right? Now take the next breath with the trees. Right? And another and another. It's a completely different experience. It's touching something very deep where I am not separate from the life of all green growing things on the surface of the planet. And as I realize that, as I'm just breathing, and we're breathing all day long. If you realize that while you're breathing, you're using your eyes of interbeing, you're in touch with your ultimate dimension, you're grounded, you're stable, you have access to that while you listen, while you work, while you drive, while you do what you do. That's also our ancestral transmission, right? This is also the wisdom of our spiritual teachers. Walk with them, breathe with them. Have you ever tried that technique of walking meditation where you walk with your ancestors? It's so nice. I walk and I'm making a step. And I'm making this step. I don't have to go very far. I have a living ancestor right now who can't walk very easily, my dad. But I could walk here across the lawn with my father and allow him through me to feel the joy of stepping on the grass. Right? If I'm suffering, I can call on Tai. Tai is a master of walking. So stable, so grounded. He could walk at the front of a group of 1,000 people and everyone, the whole line for 100 yards behind him will feel that groundedness, that stability of arriving right here, right now. It's like a wave of spiritual force moving down the street, right? But we have that capacity in us too. And Tai has transmitted to us the technique. It's very simple. He didn't hold back. He doesn't have something special. He practices, I have arrived. I am home. Right here. Right now. I feel the solidity of it. I am free. I'm solid. I'm free. In the ultimate, I dwell. Ultimate's not some far out space. It's all these conditions that come together from past all of our ancestors, from the present, all the conditions of the earth and all of our peoples that manifest this moment for us, right here, right now. Walk with your ancestors, your spiritual ancestors, your blood ancestors, and walk with them. You can take Avalokita, who is the Bodhisattva of deep listening, Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara represents our capacity to be able to listen deeply, to have spacious, open heart, fully present, so that we can hear all the cries of the world. Right? That's what Avalokiteshvara represents as a Bodhisattva. To take that sort of icon of religion out of, let's bring it down, bring it into the room. When you're able to breathe with solidity and spaciousness in your heart and listen to someone who's sharing about their suffering, you're manifesting the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara right here, right now. So you can take her there, I should say there, can take their energy and bring it into a business meeting, bring it into a family gathering over a holiday meal, right? Bring it into those moments, right? Call on the energy, because that energy lives in us. We just forget, but use it. Listening with Avalokiteshvara's heart. These are beautiful thoughts. This is the mind gladdened. The mind which is on the path, which knows the source of happiness, knows how to manifest the well-being, right? Create those conditions in our life. We can practice, we can manifest these beautiful things in the world. Right now. Right now. It's not about getting to some kingdom of heaven or pure land or utopian community somewhere. It's right now. Right? This is our moment to contribute. This is the step we can make, the breath we can take. This is the kind look we can offer. And in that way, our mothers and fathers, our grandmothers and grandfathers experience a transformation and a healing. For all their happiness and suffering is a part of us. And every moment we bring ourselves onto that good and beautiful way, and we concentrate and live into it, they're able to, like their continuation is us, they're able to manifest in this new way. This is healing, right? Super healing.